This is Audible.
Warhammer Horror: The Wicked and the Damned. Written by Josh Reynolds, Phil Kelly, and David Annandale. Narrated by Doug Bradley, John Banks, Emma Gregory, and Richard Reed. A dark bell tolls in the abyss. It echoes across cold and unforgiving worlds, mourning the fate of humanity. Terror has been unleashed, and every foul creature of the night haunts the shadows. There is naught but evil here. Alien monstrosities drift in tomb-like vessels, watching, waiting, ravenous. Baleful magics whisper in gloom-shrouded forests. Spectres scuttle across disquiet minds. From the depths of the void to the blood-soaked earth, diabolic horrors stalk the endless night to feast upon unworthy souls. Abandon hope. Do not trust to faith. Sacrifices burn on pyres of madness. Rotting corpses stir in unquiet graves. Demonic abominations leer with rictus grins and stare into the eyes of the accursed. And the ruinous gods, with indifference, look on. This is a time of reckoning, where every mortal soul is at the mercy of the things that lurk in the dark. This is the night eternal, the province of monsters and demons. This is Warhammer Horror. None shall escape damnation. And so, the bell tolls on. Silence, Part 1. The planet's name was Silence. It was a world of grey pillars and dour statues, and the shadows that stretched between them. Amid these shadows, strange shapes prowled about on stick legs. Their gilded funerary masks occasionally caught the soft light of the ceremonial lumens, and their grey shrouds rustled as they went about their eternal labours. Silence was a world of the dead, a cemetery world. Great repositories of the fallen stretched high into the pallid skies and deep beneath the skin of the earth. Towering mausoleums containing hundreds, if not thousands, of the honoured dead lined the wide, silent boulevards. Stone pits with shallow nooks housed paupers and mendicants in their untold millions. As it was in life, so it was in death. The air of the cemetery world was cold and clammy, heavy with mist and the lingering smell of incense. It hung over the streets, hiding the stink of decay. The fetal shapes of cybernetic cherubs drifted on tattered wings, their faces like golden skulls. They dragged smoking censers through the dark and the quiet, murmuring repetitive hymns in shrill, tinny voices. Condensation ran in unceasing ripples across the glassaic windows that overlooked the winding thoroughfares and avenues below. The world was all but entombed in stone and glass. It had died centuries ago, but there was no one to notice. The only inhabitants were the cyber cherubs and the mortuary servitors with their spindly legs and shrouded in human bodies. Like all servitors, they did not live so much as persist. They crept through the tombs, ensuring that all was as it should be, and everything was in its proper place. They went about their task in utter silence, save for the dull clangour of the funeral bells that draped their forms. They paused in these efforts, only to watch as those few pilgrims who came to silence traversed the grim fields of stone and statuary. Sometimes, for reasons of their own, they would follow these visitors at a distance, as if curious of their intentions, or perhaps in anticipation of the inevitable. It was the latter that was foremost in Egin Valimar's mind as he walked alone through the streets of silence. He was tall and narrow in the way of some men, and his shadow stretched far in his wake. The mortuary servitors watched him, and he watched them in turn with a soldier's vigilance. He pulled the collar of his greatcoat tight, fighting the persistent chill. The coat was black, as was the peaked commissar's cap he wore. Valimar was angry. He was often angry. At the moment, he was angry because he was on silence and not with his new regiment. He was angry because he had been ordered to come, though he wasn't sure why or by whom. And he was angry because his head hurt. It had been hurting for some time, a persistent migraine flowering within his skull. Sometimes he grew so used to the ache that he forgot all about it, and then a sudden sharp pain would remind him of its presence. It dug into the meat of him, making it hard to think of anything else. He stopped and rubbed his brow, trying to ease the increased throbbing in his temples. Beneath the pressure of his fingers, it receded, though only slightly. It was the stress of his recent posting. He sighed and lowered his hands.
I am sorry, Colonel.
He wondered if that was why he'd been ordered to come to Silence, though he could not imagine who might have wanted him to do so. He had tried to find out before his departure, but the Departamento Munitorum was an impenetrable labyrinth of bureaucracy, one he had no patience to navigate. Better to simply go along rather than risk being derelict in his duty. And in any event, if he was here, it was where he was supposed to be. He looked up. Statues lined the avenue, forgotten heroes of the Imperium, standing atop wide plinths marked with their deeds and date of death. Or in some cases, the estimated date of death. It was hard to tell sometimes. Imperial bureaucracy was a slow current. All things eventually reach the sea, but in their own time. A saying of the Colonel's. Valimar frowned, annoyed by the thought. The Colonel was dead, and sentiment was a coward's refuge. Funerary bells clanged somewhere close by. He turned, suddenly tense. Mist hung thick between the statues and tombs, all but obscuring the way he'd come. He made to hurry on, but the bells came again, closer now, to his left. He stopped and turned, itching to draw his weapon. A sudden sense of paranoia flashed through him. Perhaps this was a trap. Perhaps his enemies had summoned him here. And where better to kill a man than a cemetery world? He laughed sourly. They'd have no more luck now than they'd had before. The God Emperor watched over him. He knew it, as he knew nothing else. The one certainty in an otherwise ambiguous existence. As if reading his thoughts, the sound of bells faded. Whatever it was drawing away from him. He waited for a long moment before making to continue on. He was not sure where he was going, but he knew he had to be there on time. The mortuary servitor was waiting for him as he turned. The optic sensors within its funerary mask glowed crimson as it looked down at him. It was taller than him, but spindly. Its legs were oddly jointed lengths of metal, studded with sensor filaments, like the hairs on a spider's leg. Its body was concealed beneath a ragged shroud of grey, but Valimar could see something twitching within the folds. Unseen things whirred and clicked, and he could smell the stink of old incense clinging to the stiff, grimy cloth. The servitor's head perched at the end of an elongated neck composed of metallic vertebral segments. These rasped softly as the servitor observed him. Its golden death mask was wrought to resemble the round features of a smiling cherub. The automaton took a soft, scraping step towards him. Valimar held his ground. He could detect a hint of rotting meat beneath the omnipresent odour of incense. He did not trust machines, especially those draped in flesh. His hand fell to the las pistol holstered on his hip. The red gaze flicked down, following his hand, and then back up.
"Identify,"
the mortuary servitor asked, in a sing-song, childlike voice.
"Valimar. Commissar Egan Valimar. I am expected."
Valimar paused, wondering why he'd said that. As far as he could recall, no one was waiting for him. No one alive, at any rate. However, it seemed to have the desired effect. The servitor gave a binaric grunt and clattered out of his path. It retreated into the mists, and soon there was little sign that it had been there at all. Valimar pressed on. The ache in his head receded as he came to a small plaza containing rows of beers. He'd seen other such plazas at a distance, dotting the cityscape, according to some pattern that escaped him. He'd always been good at spotting patterns, even if he didn't understand their meaning. Each of the beers was occupied by a shroud-covered shape. He felt a chill as he passed through the rows, as if they might rise at any moment and demand his reasons for being there. He made his way towards the heart of the plaza, following the path. The mists thinned the further he went. He heard voices, muffled, indistinct. He stopped and reached for his weapon. The mist parted, and he saw two figures standing at the center of the plaza. They turned as he joined them, his hand resting on his holstered sidearm. The man was below average height and dark. He was clad in the heavy robes of an ecclesiarchy missionary, and his eyes darted nervously between Valimar and his companion. She was small in height and build, but sharp-faced and hard-eyed. She was dressed in the uniform of an Astra Militarum officer. She idly tugged at the edges of bandages, just visible beneath her sleeves. Valimar paused, wondering if he ought to salute. He settled for a respectful nod. She frowned, but returned the gesture. The little man thrust out a hand.
Oswick. Oswick Maricus. This is...
I can introduce myself, priest. I'm Field Commander Leanna Venderson, first class. And you are?
Valimar hadn't taken Maricus's hand. The little man pulled it back with a frown as Valimar concentrated on the officer.
Commissar Valimar, I am expected.
We're all expected, Commissar. Though I don't have the faintest clue as to why.
A puzzled frown spread across her features.
Come to that? I don't...
She paused and looked around, as if uncertain. Maricus nodded.
You don't know how you got here. Neither do I.
Maricus looked expectantly at Valimar.
Of course I know how I got here.
He'd taken an instant dislike to the smaller man, though he couldn't say why. And the woman seemed nervous, but then perhaps she had something to hide. Something she'd rather a commissar not know about.
I was ordered to come. A ship,
he said, finally. But he couldn't remember. He couldn't remember arriving. He looked around, seeing his surroundings as if for the first time. How had he got here?
What ship?
Maricus pressed.
I didn't come here to be interrogated.
Then why did you come?
Again, Valimar paused. He'd thought he'd known, but now he found that he could not bring the words to mind. He shook his head.
My orders are none of your concern.
She bristled and looked as if she wanted to speak, but Maricus beat her to it.
Why did any of us come?
He looked back and forth between them.
Do you remember being invited?
He looked at Valimar, then to Venderson.
What about you?
He looked around.
Maybe it doesn't matter. We're here now, and may the God Emperor keep us from harm.
Venderson snorted. Valimar glared at her.
Do not blaspheme.
He looked down at the closest of the shrouded bodies. He peered at it, trying to discern the features beneath the thin shroud. They seemed inexplicably familiar. He reached for the shroud to pull it back, but stopped as he heard the clangor of bells. He looked up and saw the dim shape of a mortuary servitor standing watchfully at the edge of the plaza. Its red gaze honed in on him, and he pulled his hand back slowly. Venderson shook her head.
They don't like it when you disturb things. They make an awful sound, like someone skinning a jirinx.
They won't let us leave either. I tried earlier. They herded me back here.
He rubbed his arms, as if cold.
God Emperor alone knows why.
Valimar saw more servitors creeping through the outermost biers, murmuring binaric prayers. Something about them set his teeth on edge. His head began to pound, and he rubbed his temples.
I have a weapon.
Only one?
Venderson patted an ornate lasgun with bayonet affixed.
Maybe we should simply wait. Someone will eventually come. They'll tell us why we're here.
And if they don't?
Why us?
The others looked at Valimar. He met their gazes, looking for any sign of falsehood, any flash of something that shouldn't be there. But there was nothing in their eyes save a reflection of his own growing confusion.
What?
Marika said.
Why us? Why here?
Valimar gestured to the beers.
Do we share some commonality?
He licked his lips, suddenly anxious. He felt the urge to run, though he could not say from what.
What's the last thing you remember?
He demanded.
What do you mean?
None of us recall why we're here or how we arrived at this place. What's the last thing you do remember?
Venderson glared suspiciously at him.
You first, Commissar.
Yes, no, this is good.
Marika said, quickly, before Valimar could reply.
We will each tell our stories and see if the answer is there.
He looked at Valimar.
You first, Commissar, please.
Valimar shook his head.
Fine.
He studied the closest of the bodies.
I remember...
He smiled.
I remember that the sky was on fire.
The Beast in the Trenches, written by Josh Reynolds, narrated by Doug Bradley.
The sky was on fire. As beginnings go, I think it has poetry. We were at war, when are we not? And the world was burning beneath us, beneath me. The air tasted of smoke, and the heat pressed down on me like the hand of the God Emperor. My ears were ringing, but I could hear men screaming up and down the trench line. They were always screaming, crying, wailing. My regiment was mostly made up of cowards and children, much to my chagrin. The ferrocrete duckboards buckled beneath me as I pushed myself to my feet and fumbled for the las pistol on my hip. The mud, we'd taken to calling it the soup, for obvious reasons, beneath the duckboards, was boiling from the heat of the barrage. The trench was sloughing into a new shape around me as I stumbled towards the nearest screams. The walls bubbled, bulging outwards or collapsing inwards. The ferrocrete frames of the line were cracked and pushed out of joint. Sometimes whole sections of the line and everything in them vanished into the soup, like they'd never existed at all. War is a hungry beast, and it gobbles its prey. A regiment can die in a moment. Triumph can turn to tragedy, victory to defeat. Only by maintaining discipline can the hunger of war be held at bay. But discipline, like ferrocrete, can crack and burst and vanish under the mud, unless someone tends to it. Men moved around me, but I barely saw them. Grey shadows, uniforms coated with mud and ash, environment masks giving everyone the same inhuman features. I didn't often wear my mask, despite the way the heat bit at my lungs and sinuses. I wanted them to see me, to see my face, to see that I wasn't like them. They needed to be reminded of that. I needed to be reminded of that. Standards, discipline, had to be maintained. Coughing, I stumbled down the line, shoving men aside. They didn't protest, or I didn't hear them if they did. They saw my face, the black peaked cap, the coat, stained with mud though it was, and they knew me, knew who I was, what I was, and they straightened at their positions. They went quiet, like good soldiers. But where there are good soldiers, there are bad soldiers. There are always bad soldiers in every regiment. The lazy and the cowardly, the unscrupulous and the mad. The God Emperor saw them, and I saw them too. I had been trained my whole life to see them, to see the signs of faltering courage in a man, sometimes before the soldier in question even realized it. and then to act. Cowardice could spread like an illness if left unchecked. And not just cowardice. Licentiousness, disrespect, these found fertile soil in untended souls. If not dealt with, they could bring a regiment to its knees, cripple it, or even destroy it. But not that day, not then, with the sky burning with chemical fire and the trenches turning to soup around me. The screaming was bad for morale, bad for the regiment, and I knew my duty. Las pistol in hand, I swept down the line, moving quicker. The longer the screams went on, the worse the effect would be. Another lesson learned in the scholar progenium. They taught me so many valuable things there. I give thanks to the God Emperor every night for those times, grueling though they were. The trenches I passed through were irregular canyons of mud, bolstered by support slabs of ferrocrete. In places, prefab bunkers of stone and metal had been sunk into the mud, their regimental markings obscured by grime and damage. Heavy environment netting had been strung over the tops of some places, in order to keep out the worst of the inclement weather. It didn't work here. It rarely worked anywhere. But we strung it regardless, as the manuals insisted. We dug our trenches to regulation depth, despite the mud, and set our guns and placed our emplacements. There is a right way to do things, and a wrong way. I know this. Another lesson, and one I took readily to heart. The right way was the way the God Emperor wished it to be. The wrong way was the way of heresy, of disrespect and ill-discipline. Armour-plas-firing pavises lined the top of the trenches, and men lined up behind them, standing on overturned crates or ferrocrete slabs. The sound of las-fire split the air as the soldiers vented their frustrations on the unseen enemy. It was always the same. During or just after a barrage, they would expend valuable charges from their las rifles. The officers had given up trying to stop them from shooting at ghosts. An odd word, that. Ghosts. But appropriate, I think, given our foe. They pounded us from afar, rarely daring to draw close. Rarely deigning, I should say. I couldn't remember a day without their guns, without that hateful rhythm. Even when they were silent, the air echoed with them. I couldn't escape, even in sleep. If not for my training, I might well have been driven mad by it. Some among my charges had been. The incessant bombardment ate away at their simple psyches, breaking their minds and spirits. When that happened, I had to be quick. I couldn't allow the weakness to spread. I reached the source of the screams after a few moments of laboured stumbling and shoved my way through the grey crowd of masked loiterers. "Back to your positions," I growled, shoving men against the sides of the trench. "Get back! Back!" They muttered darkly, their voices muffled by their masks. But they knew better than to argue. Arguing with a commissar was the equivalent of sleeping beneath a battle tank. One could get away with it, but only rarely. When the space had cleared, I saw the screamer. He was young and had torn his mask off, exposing milk-pale features and eyes so blue that I thought at first he'd suffered some injury. His uniform was spattered with mud and ash, and his weapon was nowhere to be seen. A medical corpsman crouched beside him, the caduceus on his shoulder plate faded and all but scraped away. The screamer did not appear to be injured. I holstered my weapon. "Why is he screaming?" The corpsman looked up at me, eyes wide. He mumbled something, his voice muffled by his mask. I had never met a corpsman of any use. I shoved him aside and caught the screamer by the collar. He thrashed in my grip, boneless, like a worm. He babbled nonsense, in that slurring dialect of low Gothic shared by most of the regiment. I had never bothered to learn it, as most of them eventually figured out the right way to talk. "On your feet," I said, dragging him upright. "Answer me." His hand flapped uselessly at the wall of the trench, where bones were being squeezed from the mud like excrement. Skulls and femurs and shattered rib cages, the refuse of the battlefield. The mud cooked the dead if the corpsmen didn't get to them first. It boiled away the meat and muscle, leaving only bone. I paused, taking in the sight. Sometimes, when the trenches clenched just right, the bones surfaced. They poured down and pooled across the floor of the trench. Most were reabsorbed before the trench settled, but sometimes they remained. I shoved the man back and plucked a steaming skull free of the soup. I held it up before him. "This? This is what you're screaming about?" I caught him again before he could turn away. He was a coward then, like all of them. What use is a soldier that can't face death? Like a gun that won't fire. The air shuddered as the dull crump of enemy artillery sounded. The trench shook and twisted as men lost their footing or fought to brace the ferrocrete slabs that held the bulk of the mud at bay. Fearful eyes darted in wild circles behind masks. A babble of voices rose. Between the mud and the screamers' wails, they were on edge. Discipline had to be maintained, and I had to be the one to do it. I caught him by his flak armour and dragged him close. "Be quiet," I said. "Quiet!" But he didn't stop. Perhaps he couldn't. I am no expert in the ways of the mind. Perhaps his had broken in such a way that the world about him had been reduced to something so infinitely terrifying that he could think of no other option than to scream and scream and scream. The noise of it was like a knife digging into my head. Worse than the guns, almost. I had to silence him, for the good of the regiment, for the sake of discipline. I dragged him towards the collapsed wall of the trench and the bones. He tried to twist away, hands flapping at my arm. Weak blows, weak mind, weak link. I tossed the skull I held aside and drove him face first into the tide of bones. "Idiot," I snapped. "Coward. The dead can't hurt you. But I will if you don't stop this foolishness." He struggled in my grip, whining. The corpsman had fallen over and scrambled back, and the others were watching, staring. I wanted them to. I wanted them to see that there was nothing to be frightened of here. Nothing except me. His scream changed, became a wail of desolation, a child's cry. Weak, as I said. Too young for the battlefield, perhaps. But the God Emperor had chosen him, had brought him here. The least he could do was show some courage. That was all he asked of his servants. The courage to do what was necessary, whatever the cost. I said this to him, to them all, as I held him there in the mud, ignoring his struggles. The opportunity to impart a lesson was not to be ignored, even amidst the confusion of an artillery barrage. His struggles grew more frenzied. I forced him deeper until the bones were tumbling over my arms and slapping against my chest. His boots caught me in the shin as his hands dug futilely into the mud either side of his head. He clawed at the wall of the trench, still screaming, though I could only hear the barest edge of it over the guns. And then, all at once, he went still. It was so sudden I almost released him, but I didn't. I held him for a moment more, maybe two. I had to make sure, you see. He needed to understand the crime he had committed. Cowardice was the weed in the garden of victory, fear the vice of the weak, and I would suffer no weakness in my regiment. And when I finally hauled him back, it was clear that I had overestimated him. He had been weaker than I had imagined. I knew in that moment that I had done him a favour, and it annoyed me. Weakness was to be punished, not rewarded. He was a dead weight in my hands, and I let him fall. His body crashed to the duckboards and lay unmoving. His blue eyes, wide and empty, stared at nothing. I felt the gazes of the rest settle on me like hands, and I turned, meeting their bewildered stares unflinchingly. "What are you looking at?" I said softly. They said nothing, could say nothing. Their lives were mine, to weigh and judge as I saw fit, and they knew it, even as they knew I would not judge them unfairly. Some commissars might, petty tyrants hiding behind his authority, but I was not one of them. The God Emperor's hand was at my shoulder, and his light in me. Sometimes I wondered if they could see it, if they can see it, the light, I mean, or were their souls too simple to perceive such glorious luminescence? A question I have often asked myself, if I'm being honest. Am I blessed among the faithful? Or is such grace the common burden of humanity, shared by all, whether they realize it or not? I confess, it troubles me. But at that moment I was not thinking of grace or light. I was thinking of the dead man at my feet and the way his eyes stared up past me as if seeking the stars. Blue eyes. No one in the regiment had blue eyes. I know, because it is my job to know such things. When everyone wears masks for the majority of a 36 Terran standard hour day, you learn to recognize them by their eyes, by their voices, and the way they walk. I recognized him, I thought. Not by name, but his eyes. Had they changed? Minor mutation wasn't unheard of in such conditions as these, another sign of weakness. His crimes compounded themselves even in death. Or perhaps there was some toxin in the air or in the soup that had changed him. The thought sent a chill through me, and I admit I glanced then at the mask hanging from my belt and cursed my bravado. It was only because of this momentary failing that I saw the locket, a little thing of gold. It had escaped his armour during his struggles. It lay across his unmoving chest, the tarnished gilt all but obscured by filth. I reached down and tore it loose. I let it dangle from my fingers and spin, and I saw that there was a catch to it. Something inside, perhaps. A secret thing. Secrets were another crack in the wall of discipline. Soldiers were not allowed secrets. Their lives were best kept simple and uncomplicated, scraped sharp and straight like the edge of a bayonet. More weakness. Another crime for the tally. His death was more justified with every passing moment, and I felt a flush of satisfaction. The God Emperor had guided my hand, as he had done so many times before. "Get him up," I said. The corpsman knelt beside the screamer as I studied the locket. Despite myself, I was curious. I wondered what it held. A picture? A message? Something else? I closed my hand around it. "What are you waiting for? I said get him up."
"He's dead," the corpsman said in a hollow voice.
"I know. I know a dead man when I see one." I stuffed the locket into my coat. "It's just as well. The penalty for contraband is the same as that for cowardice, summary execution. The sentence has been administered." I looked around. "The rest of you, get back to your posts." The corpsman looked up at me. His gaze was unreadable. Brown eyes. Placid. A soldier's eyes.
"What about him?"
I looked down at the body. "Feed him to the soup." Someone talked, of course. They always do. Word got back to the colonel, as it always did, and I was summoned. I went, obviously. While commissars are ostensibly outside the chain of command, in practice we are a part of it. Some may flaunt this to their betterment, but I have more discipline than most. Without rules, codified or not, discipline cannot be maintained. Thus I subordinate myself to those with greater authority, as vested in them by the god emperor. The colonel was one such. He was old and hard, like the fossilized lumps of bone that occasionally surfaced from the soup, with a sturdy frame that bespoke a welcome solidity of spirit. He wore his uniform well, and his face was a mass of scars and antiquated cybernetics. Part of his jaw was metal, and one eye. The eye whirred and clicked, lenses shifting. I often wondered what it was like to see the world through such a mechanism. Were things clearer, or did it only add to the confusion of the moment? I regret never asking him when I had the chance.
"I'm told you throttled a boy, Valimar,"
he said without preamble, as I stooped to enter the command bunker. Right to the point, that was the colonel. I knew his name, but names are for civilians. Ranks serve to remind soldiers of their place in the grand machinery of war. "Commissar," I corrected. A game between us begun the day I had been seconded to the regiment. He had been old even then, and I young. I was older now, but the game continued. I looked around. No one else was there, no one of importance, I should say. Just his aide, a nondescript little entity of no particular interest or importance. Another grey shape among a regiment of grey shapes. Usually the colonel was accompanied by a herd of lesser men, junior officers and their aides. And, of course, the colonel's own aide would be bustling in the background, a silent shadow. They were all pale shadows of the colonel, as the men of the regiment were but shades of me. Their discipline and faith were but reflections of my own. You think it arrogant of me to make such a claim? I assure you it is the truth. As a commissar, I am the regiment's soul. If it falters, it is only because I faltered first. That is what it means to be a commissar. You are the regiment, the body militarum. As the regiment suffers, so do you. As it prospers, so will you. People, soldiers, I should say, do not understand the role of a political officer. They do not see the necessity of me. This is because they lack the foresight of a man like the colonel. The colonel understood me. He knew me, and knew my faith was strong. It was why he trusted me. No, we weren't friends, but we trusted one another. The colonel cleared his throat as his aide brought him a mug of recaf.
"Why did you throttle the boy, commissar?"
"He was a mutant, a coward, and a thief." The latter was an assumption. I had not yet had time to examine the locket, but I thought the odds were good that he had stolen it.
"And so you throttled him?"
"An object lesson." The colonel laughed. It was a harsh sound, like the croaking of a bird.
"Would not a lass round to the head have served just as well?"
He tilted his head and fixed me with that false eye, its lenses glowing a deep bloody red.
"Or were you particularly incensed by his crimes?"
I said nothing. He smiled, as if I had responded.
"You do take it so personally, don't you, Valimar? As if their failings are yours."
"Commissar," I said.
"Commissar,"
he amended.
"How many is this now? Since we arrived, I mean."
It was not a real question, and I saw no reason to answer it. The colonel had greater concerns than the method of a coward's execution. The war had been dragging on for months, years even. It was hard to tell sometimes, when day and night blended into one grey stretch of nothing. But that was the way of it. The god emperor commanded, and we had only to obey. When he saw I wasn't going to answer, he grunted and turned away. Outside, I could hear the thunder, rhythmic and piercing.
"Their rate of fire is Impressive,
he said, as he studied the maps and picked captures plastered along the wall. He tapped a map.
No way to silence the guns without crossing open ground. No way to cross open ground without losing at least a third of the regiment to defensive emplacements. No way to break the defensive emplacements without air support, and no air support, thanks to the guns. A pretty trap. And here we sit, caught fast in it.
He looked at me.
Some of my officers don't agree with my assessment. What about you?
I glanced at the maps without interest. Unlike some who wore the black cap and coat, I knew my place. I was no line officer and did not pretend otherwise. My duty was to follow orders, not to give them or suggest them. The colonel had his own advisers. I was a different sort of sounding board. You are the colonel of this regiment, not me. If you think it's a trap, then it's a trap. He chuckled.
A good answer. I wish I had 100 like you, Valimar.
Commissar.
Of course. Commissar. Regrettably, you are only one. As am I.
The regret in his voice was palpable. I didn't like it. The regulations were clear. Regret led to doubt, and doubt to fear, and fear to treachery. Strip dissenters of their rank, I said. He shook his head.
You see simple solutions where there are none.
I didn't know what that meant, so I let it pass. Would you like me to investigate?
No. That's the last thing I want.
He changed the subject.
How are the men? What's their mood?
Loyal, I said, without hesitation. He laughed. I heard an echoing chuckle behind me and glanced around. I saw the colonel's aide tidying stacks of reports. The aide ducked away from my eyes. I knew that he was frightened of me, though I thought little about it. He was right to be. Not even his relationship with the colonel would save him from my judgment if I'd decided against him. Even so, I waited for him to scuttle to the other side of the bunker before elaborating. Morale has suffered, but is within acceptable parameters. Talk of desertion is inevitable, but I have identified the potential vectors already.
Vectors? Men, you mean?
4 men, 2 women. The colonel nodded. A nerve bundle in the prosthetic part of his jaw twitched.
And your diagnosis?
I shrugged. Observation, for the moment.
I'm surprised that you haven't disposed of them already.
There is no point. And they haven't committed a crime. Yet. My hand dropped to my pistol, and I patted the holster fondly. They will. And when they do, I will make an example of them.
Not all at once, I hope.
He looked at me.
Not again.
There was the faintest edge of reprimand in his tone. It irked me, for I had not exceeded my authority. I never did. I had merely done my duty. The men knew it, and so did he. I had only ever done my duty, as the God Emperor commanded. It was what I lived for. That will depend on them, I said, not letting my anger colour my words. The colonel studied me, his false eye clicking as the lenses oscillated through the light spectrum. Then he turned away once more.
Dismissed, Commissar.
I saluted and left, nearly stumbling over his aide. I kicked the fool aside, ignoring his muffled protests. He shouldn't have been underfoot, eavesdropping on his betters. The aides were inveterate gossips. Killing every one of them would have significantly improved the regiment's morale, I have no doubt, even now. Men were loitering near the bunker, and I smelled the stink of narc sticks on the air. I stared at them, keeping my face carefully blank. Shouldn't you be at your posts? Narc sticks were forbidden while on duty. They dulled the senses and lulled men into a relaxed state. Also the glow made them easy prey for enemy snipers. The soldiers scattered like frightened birds. I had hunted birds as a boy, before the scholar progenium had made me a man. I still remember the flutter of their tiny hearts as I held them, and the wet crack of their fragile bones as I closed my fingers and twisted. The men had much in common with the birds, little lives with no use save that which they were given. The regiment gave them, gave us, purpose. And yet so few of them were grateful. They lacked the wit to see the light, as I did. I've said this before, but it bears repeating. They were brutes and fools, and I was the angel of their better nature, guiding them as the God Emperor guided me. That is my duty, and I am glad of it. I made my way back to my quarters. It had begun to rain. Fat, ashy drops pelted the environment netting and echoed rhythmically against the tops of the bunkers. It ran down my cap and beneath the collar of my coat, stinging my neck. The rain was hot, like the mud, and when it fell, it did so in sheets. I was forced to duck beneath one of the temporary shelters hacked into the trench wall. Like all of them, it was a simple divot covered by netting or scrap metal. Sometimes the men added to them, carving out new roads in the dark, shadowing the twists and turns of the trenches. It was against regulations, but I had never caught anyone at it. Part of me was almost grateful. I stood in the damp, listening to the rain thud against the metal sheet overhead. Out in the trench, indistinct grey shapes shuffled slowly. The enemy had ceased firing. They always did when it rained. I wondered if the weather interfered with their targeting systems. Perhaps it was more toxic to them than it was to us. There were numerous Xenos species which faltered in conditions a human could easily endure. This war had proved that, if nothing else. Our guns, somewhere far to the rear, continued to fire. Dull orange flashes crested the lip of the trench. It had been days, weeks perhaps, since I had dared to look out over the waste ground that lay between us. The enemy snipers were adept at concealment and liked to creep close. We'd lost nearly 100 men before we'd learned that lesson. That was what the pavises were for, but even they didn't work all the time. There were bodies melting in the soup that could attest to that. Something thumped against my boot. A shard of bone jutted from the soft wall of the shelter, corroded identity tags dangling from it. I was reminded of the contraband in my pocket, and I fished it out. The locket was small and crafted in a way I was not familiar with. It clearly opened, but I could not find the catch. As I ran my fingers over the curved shape, I thought again of its former owner, of his eyes staring at nothing. Bright blue eyes. Unusual, that. I still couldn't remember his name. That wasn't surprising. My mind kept going back to his eyes. They bothered me. Reminded me of something else, perhaps. Someone coughed. I smelled the pungent whiff of a narc stick and turned. There was someone else in the shelter. I hadn't noticed them at first. They crouched in the far corner, a heavy canvas slicker over their uniform. Man or woman, I couldn't tell. The regiment made use of both. I had brought many soldiers of both sexes up on charges of unlawful fraternization since our arrival. Their mask was rolled up past their mouth, allowing them to suckle on the narc stick unhindered. The goggle eyes stared at me, and for an instant I almost allowed myself a laugh at the incongruity of the situation. "Shouldn't you be at your post?" I asked, stuffing the locket back into my coat. I didn't know whether they'd seen me trying to open it or not. I didn't know why it bothered me to think that they might have.
"I am, Commissar," they said. A man's voice.
He pointed to the opposite side of the trench. A lasgun lay propped against the firing step there.
"Just wanted to get out of the rain."
He spoke low Gothic with a barbarous accent that grated on my ears. The regiment had been formed in some backwater system, agri-worlds mostly. One of the reasons discipline was so bad, I suspected. "You left your weapon in the rain," I looked down at him. "Punishment detail, 12 hours. The rain was beginning to slacken, the rhythm fading. He rose slowly, surly. I knew his type. A loafer and a slacker. Only a soldier if a sergeant or superior officer was present. "And narc sticks are forbidden when on duty. Punishment detail, 6 hours.
"I've been on duty for 18 already," he said quietly.
He was arguing with me. Not unusual, but it had been weeks since the last time. Defiance was punishable by death. My heart quickened. My mouth was dry. "Then you'll be used to it," I said. I kept my voice even. I didn't want to be accused of provocation if there were witnesses. The thought made me glance around. My inattention almost proved fatal. Even now, I don't know whether his lunge was intentional or provoked by surprise. As the rain stopped, the enemy started. The roar of their guns split the air. Somewhere on the other side of our lines, a trench collapsed and something exploded. The whole trench line shook and the soup shifted beneath our feet. The shelter contracted. It was a sudden thing, faster than I'd ever seen. One moment I was facing him, the next we were driven together as the mud boiled around us. It crashed down, striking me in the back and on my head and shoulders. I stumbled, and then he was there, and something gleamed in his hand. Later, I wondered if he had actually been attempting to aid me. But in that instant, instinct prevailed. As I felt his weight, my hand went to my pistol. We were driven back and sent sliding, one way and then the next, by the convulsions of the mud. I tried to shout, but all I got for my trouble was a mouthful of bitter foulness. We struggled there in the dark. Some might assume he was simply trying to get away, but I know he wasn't. It was rare that a soldier tried to kill a commissar. Such a crime meant execution, or worse. But it happened. It had happened to me more than once. Sometimes out of desperation, other times because they were mad. But this time was different. In the crushing dark, pressed close, his mask was askew. I saw his eyes, blue, bright blue, like the skies of a world I barely remembered, like the eyes of the man I'd executed that morning. And for a moment it was him. Just for an instant. It was only when I felt the tip of his blade catch in the tangled folds of my coat that my shock gave way to anger. I could hear his muffled curses, and they sounded more like the grunts of a beast. I drove my elbow into the side of his head, trying to open a gap big enough to draw my weapon. His bayonet tore strips from my coat as he flailed. I caught at his hand, earning myself a gash on the forearm. His knees sank into my midsection, and I gasped. He gripped my throat, and his panting took on an eager pulse. The tip of the bayonet kissed my cheek, and my fingers fastened around his wrist. I squeezed, and his hand spasmed. The knife fell away, and I lunged after it. Bubbling mud splattered me, burning my face and neck. My attacker crashed down atop me, his hands scrabbling at my scalp. I caught the hilt of the bayonet and rolled, driving it into something soft. He made a quiet sound, and his eyes widened behind his goggles. He slumped into the running mud and was pushed to the ground. I jerked the bayonet free and wrenched myself loose from the collapsing shelter. I snatched up my cap as I stumbled back. My heart thundered, and for a moment I feared it would burst. I slid down the opposite wall of the trench, watching as his body was slowly drawn into the soup. His eyes stared blankly at me as his head was covered by a shroud of mud. They weren't blue at all. Had I imagined it then? Had the stress of the moment fooled me? I had no answers. As I sat heavily on a firing step, cap and bayonet in hand, I watched until he was all gone, and all trace of our fight with him. I looked at the bayonet, caked in mud and stained red. I heard voices, shouts from up and down the line as corpsmen saw to the injured. I stuffed the blade into my coat. Smoke boiled down the line and the shapes moved through it. They were coming to check on the integrity of the line. They saw me and stopped. Four of them. One, a corpsman. "Commissar," he said hesitantly. I wondered if it was the same corpsman as before. I donned my cap before answering. "A shelter collapsed. No one else made it out." Later, in my quarters, I considered the bayonet and the locket. Two more incongruent items I couldn't imagine. What did one have to do with the other? Nothing on the face of it. And yet, there was a connection. I simply didn't know what it was. Not yet. But it had to mean something. Everything meant something. I had learned that as a boy, and nothing I had seen since had disproved it. Even the most innocuous of phrases meant something. "That is the last thing I want." That was what the colonel had said. But it wasn't what he'd meant. I knew him well enough to know that. He was worried about something, and not just the enemy, something else. That meant I should be worried as well. My quarters were utilitarian, a simple prefab shelter set into a reinforced divot towards the rear of the lines. There were cracks in the walls and stains from where the soup had boiled through in the night. My bed was a simple cot, and my desk was an empty crate balanced on two blocks of ferrocrete. I rarely stayed in my quarters. I rarely slept. I came back only when necessary. I do not care for the feeling of being confined in such places. Too much like a cell or a tomb. And there was always so much to be done. Punishments to be handed down, discipline to be enforced, decisions to be made. What was worrying the colonel? I sat at my desk, staring at the blade and locket, thinking, trying to at least. I knew I should have reported the attack. Instead, I'd obfuscated the matter. Some instinct had prompted me to do so, and I was not one to ignore such glimmerings. The God Emperor spoke to us all. One but had to listen, to be gifted with his wisdom. I knew he was speaking to me. He always had. And right then, he was warning me, telling me that something was happening just out of sight. I felt curiously alone. I always have. I am not, by nature, inclined to the company of others. It is why I am effective in my duty. But now I felt isolated, alone in a crowd, as if I were lost behind enemy lines. I resolved to investigate the matter. If something was going on, it would be best if I found out quickly and handled it. The colonel would approve of my taking the initiative. If there was a problem with the regiment, it was my duty to deal with it. I felt better for having set my course. Uncertainty is a crack in the wall of faith. One cannot question the path ahead without risking a fall. I rose and went to my cot. Beneath it was a crate. I dragged it out and opened it, as I had done every day of my time with the regiment. Routine is the sentry on the walls of the mind. It is important to establish and follow a pattern. Divergence leads to mistakes, mistakes to failure, and failure to defeat. A slippery slope must be walked with care. Inside the crate was everything I had confiscated in the course of my duties. Ordinarily, such contraband was turned over to the quartermaster for destruction, but I had never got around to it. There were always more important matters to attend to, and what did it matter where it was kept? The crate had once held ammunition for something, I forget what. Now it held what I had come to think of as my collection. A foolish thought, I admit. And in any case, I hadn't started it, only added to it. The seed of the collection had belonged to my predecessor. I'd discovered it upon taking up my duties. I suspect that he'd been using it to reward his favourites in the regiment. He'd been an old man when the regiment was young. His edge had been dulled by too many soft postings, or so the colonel had said. That was why he'd requested a new commissar, a more vigorous one, capable of helping him whip the regiment into shape. And that was exactly what I did. I found the weak links and removed them, making the rest stronger. The colonel had approved, had left me to it, knowing that it was necessary. He was a wise man. But wisdom is often not enough. You must have a will to equal it. I had the will, and to ensure its strength, I tested it every day. The collection helped. Over the years, I had added to it, thoughtlessly at first, and then with more consideration. There were bits of jewellery and forbidden reading material, articles of clothing, flasks of rot gut and narcotics. In the years since I'd joined the regiment, the collection had grown in leaps and bounds as I doled out the necessary punishments. My collection served to remind me of the many temptations that threatened the integrity of the regiment, temptations of the body, mind, and soul. It reminded me that I had to be alert, watchful. I often examined the items, one by one, in my rare moments of solitude, remembering the moment of their owner's execution and the satisfaction of duty fulfilled, the look in their eyes as my last pistol snuffed out the last embers of their life. I like to think that some, at least, understood in their final moments that they knew I had no choice in the matter and took no pleasure from it. Satisfaction, certainly, but not pleasure, never that. I took something from each of them so that I would never forget the price of a life. Duty weighs heavily on an honest man, but he carries the burden regardless. I added the locket and the bayonet to the collection. It seemed fitting. Then I closed it up. I allowed myself only a few moments with it, a day, just enough to remind myself what was in it, to remember. And then I put it away. I spent the rest of the evening on paperwork as a reward. Unlike some of my peers in the commissariat, I enjoyed paperwork. Thus were the walls of the Imperium maintained. It was not all Ferrocretan lasguns. Numbers and figures, reports and analyses, all were equally vital to the proper running of war. A strong bureaucracy was the unbending spine of empire. But as I stamped, signed, and filed, I found myself wondering if the enemy had their own bureaucracy to match ours. I paused, realizing that the guns had fallen silent. The enemy had ceased their efforts for the cycle. They would resume in a few hours. Once, we might have gone over the top, seized the moment the